President Trump promises White House economists deliver. How they say companies paying less in tax is good for you. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rosdahl. It is Monday, the 16th of October. Good as always to have you along, everybody. It can be, shall we say, difficult to separate the news wheat from the remaining chaff and all the words coming out of Washington of late. Every now and then, though, there is something of substance that happens, and today was one of those days. President Trump has, as you know, been talking about corporate taxes a lot and how, as we told you Friday, making companies pay less in tax would boost wages for the average American family by about $4,000 a year. This morning, the White House Council of Economic Advisors published a white paper containing its economic logic, as well as a convenient list of all the economists whose work they used in coming up with their numbers. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams caught up with a couple of them.
The White House says lower taxes would convince companies to repatriate profits stashed overseas. Arpana Mathur is with the Conservative American Enterprise Institute and cited in the report.
The hope is that by making U.S. corporate tax rates more competitive, we would actually keep a lot of those profits back in the U.S. and those would eventually find the way into higher wages for workers.
Another argument, cutting corporate taxes will prompt business expansion. James Hines is with the University of Michigan Law School.
Greater business expansion basically always winds up to the benefit of workers. The question is how much.
Hines's research also made it into the White House paper. He says the theory is sound, but an income boost of $4,000 per family is really pushing the limits of the data.
It's just the extrapolations that I think are the part of the report that seems very much on the high end of the effect on household incomes.
Kimberly Clausing of Reed College, also cited in the report, says the Council of Economic Advisors was selective in how they used research.
A less generous interpretation is that it's a deliberate attempt to mislead the public to convince them that business tax cuts will actually help workers.
She says what works in theory doesn't work in real life.
Wage growth has been anemic despite really high corporate after-tax profits in recent years. So it's unclear what the magic elixir is that now means that higher after-tax profits will suddenly translate into greater wages.
Most economists say it's companies and their shareholders who will reap the biggest benefits from a cut in corporate taxes. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
The Social Security Administration says benefits are going to go up 2% next year to account for inflation. It's technically known as the COLA, cost of living adjustment. It affects about 66 million Social Security recipients. This is the first time cost of living benefits have risen more than a microscopic smidge in a couple of 3 years. But as decent as 2% might seem on its face, that rate does leave a lot to be desired for seniors on fixed incomes, as Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports.
People aged 65 and older who rely heavily on Social Security have had a pretty rough time of it recently. Interest rates are low, so returns on savings have been dismal. Inflation has been pretty muted, which is good for folks on a fixed income, but some prices have been rising faster than others, says Greg McBride at Bankrate.com.
For seniors that are putting out a lot of their expenses towards things like health care, their personal rate of inflation is going to be much higher.
Seniors like Charlie Lester, he's 80, a retired government worker living in Southern California.
The cost of rent, health insurance, groceries, prescription medicines, and not much else exceed my Social Security and pension.
He's tapping his savings, but that'll run out in 5 years, and his doctor says he could live 10 or more.
I've had 3 unexpected illnesses, and each one of those involves substantial expenses.
The annual cost of living adjustment for Social Security is based on the Consumer Price Index for urban wage earners and clerical workers, not retirees. Kent Smetters at the Wharton School says healthcare hits older Americans with a budgetary double whammy.
Elderly people spend more money on healthcare, and healthcare expenses rise generally faster than the average CPI.
And Dean Baker at the Center for Economic and Policy Research says medical advances may actually be making matters worse.
We have a new drug that costs much more than the drug that we might have used previously.
And the annual Consumer Price Index doesn't capture that kind of cost increase well at all. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
The big news in tech today is that we're all a lot less secure than we thought. Yeah, no, I know that could be the tech headline anytime, but hear me out. Belgian researchers have identified a vulnerability in the way most of us connect to Wi-Fi. And if and or when that vulnerability is exploited, credit cards, passwords, pretty much anything we type could be at risk. Marketplace's Jed Kim has that one.
When you, say, enter your credit card number online to buy something, that data is encrypted at many levels. One basic level is called WPA2 encryption. It hides the data we send and receive specifically over Wi-Fi.
It would be like close to 2.9 billion devices worldwide.
Dimitrios Pavlakis is an analyst with ABI Research. He says WPA2 can now be cracked. The security expert who discovered this even named the problem crack with a K. The good news is there's no sign that hackers have used it. No one's yet said,
"Release the Kraken!"
What, am I not going to play it? Getting cracked would require a savvy hacker to be close to a Wi-Fi router. Tiffany Rad is a cybersecurity expert with Anatrope. She says homes aren't likely targets, but companies?
I'm concerned when I read about this crack about my healthcare data for banks where I do my banking.
It's yet another front for IT departments to fight. Fortunately, weapons are available, says Dallas Bischoff. He directs security services for the company PCM.
A number of the vendors out there that write the code that enable the protocol have already started to release patches.
He says responding to new threats doesn't necessarily mean huge unexpected costs. Many companies now factor sudden needs for cyber fixes into their budgets. I'm Jed Kim for Marketplace.
Release the Kraken. I thought that was pretty good myself. Wall Street today? Any guesses? We'll have the details when we do the numbers. While we wait some more to get the actual details of the GOP's tax plan, we are going to keep on digging into some of the things that might find their way into an eventual bill. So if the GOP cuts taxes the way it says it is going to, and if Republicans are as worried about the debt and deficit as they say they are, then they're going to have to find loopholes to close and deductions to get rid of to help pay for the aforementioned tax cuts, which gets us in a roundabout kind of way to charitable giving. Americans gave away nearly $390 billion last year, and Republicans have said they will keep the charitable donation deduction. But the tax plan the GOP has actually introduced is making a lot of nonprofits, that is, recipients of those charitable donations, uneasy. Marketplace's Adrian Hill explains.
As a public radio listener, you've been asked for donations a time or two, or 200.
Your monthly contributions will help keep public radio stations and programming on the air for years. It's good for
an ask, typically followed by a phone number, and more often than not, the promise that your gift is tax deductible. And yes, Kai's dulcet tones are compelling. You can feel good about supporting your member station. But how much does the promise of that tax break matter, broadly?
We know that incentives, in fact, are really important.
Jeff Moore is the chief strategy officer at Independent Sector, which represents nonprofits. The group sponsored some research from Indiana University's Lilly Family School of Philanthropy.
One of the really interesting things we found is just how responsive givers are to tax incentives.
Take tax incentives away, and many folks will give less, billions less, according to that Indiana University study. And says Moore, that's exactly what the GOP framework could do. It's a little complicated, like everything tax-related. But basically, the GOP wants to double the standard deduction and remove a lot of other write-offs.
That proposal is likely to greatly decrease the fraction of taxpayers who itemize their deductions.
John Bacchia is an econ professor at Williams College. This matters, he says, because
itemizers are the only ones who get a tax incentive to donate to charity.
So under the GOP framework, the only people who'd be left to take the charitable deduction would be the wealthiest taxpayers. And there are some concerns, he says, if the government's only subsidizing the charitable contributions of the rich.
If the rich are more likely to donate to the Heritage Foundation and the middle class is more likely to donate to, like, the Sierra Club or something, this is going to affect which of those organizations get funds.
Steve Taylor is Senior Vice President for Public Policy at United Way Worldwide.
It's not that United Way is for or against tax reform.
But he says the plan as it's been proposed is exactly the wrong way to go about it if you want to encourage more giving.
Whether you're wealthy or middle class or low income, that shouldn't matter in determining whether you're taxed on your donations to charity.
Many charitable organizations, including his, are pushing for a universal tax deduction for charitable giving, a write-off anyone could take. But it would cost, and it isn't on the list of tax breaks that Republicans seem most interested in paying for. I'm Adrienne Hill for Marketplace.
One of the remarkable things about the fires up in Northern California, in addition to their speed and the scale of the destruction, is which buildings burned and where those buildings were. The Tubbs Fire, which hit the city of Santa Rosa, has burned more than 35,000 acres. It is, as of today, 70% contained. That's according to CAL FIRE. The thing is, though, a lot of the homes that burned weren't on the official maps that show the places most at risk for wildfire. Doug Smith is a staff writer at the LA Times. He had the story in the paper over the weekend. Thanks for coming into the studio.
Thank you.
Tell me about this Coffee Park subdivision and why it stands out just in terms of this fire.
We published a photo the first day of the fire that showed this neighborhood being destroyed. We had a crossover that you could see before and after in the same photo. And I just thought, I'd never seen anything like this before. This wasn't the kind of rural intermix neighborhood we're used to seeing that gets burned in a wildfire. This was a city neighborhood. And so when I was asked to do something on the fire, I said, well, let's try to find out what happened in this neighborhood.
What did you learn about where the fire hazard zone was for Coffee Park and how that affected the way this neighborhood burned?
The fire hazard zone mapping is very complex, and it's made complex by nature, by physics, by statistics, but also by law. And the state has a mandate to map hazard zones, but they have a distinction between state responsibility and local. And the city of Santa Rosa is in local responsibility, so the state couldn't extend its maps into the city. And so that neighborhood, though we know now from experience, was at extreme risk, was not shown as being at risk.
The amazing thing about this fire is that literally in these pictures you just talked about, across the street is fine. There are trees still standing that were fine. And the fire scientist you talked to said that meant it wasn't a wall of flame that moved through. It was blowing sparks and cinders from miles away.
It could have been miles away. And that's correct. The neighborhood burned itself down. It was fire that got started in one or several. We don't really know how many houses were ignited by the firebrands, by the wildfire.
Firebrands are embers that blow?
Embers,
gotcha,
yes.
Gotcha, okay.
But once the fire started in one house, the heat generated by that house caught the neighboring houses on fire. Huh. And those fires would have been prevented on a normal day by fire response. The fire department would come and put the fire out. But the fire department was in a state of extreme emergency, and they were somewhere else, and there was nobody there to put out the fires.
Does the state of California have to give itself the authority to require special zoning and regulations for localities? I mean, it's a regulatory morass, really.
That's correct. And the current law was inspired by the Tunnel Fire in 1991, I believe it was, that burned hundreds of houses in Oakland Bay area.
Yeah.
The law would have to be amended to allow the state to extend its maps into local jurisdiction areas. And under the current law, the state can't even require the local jurisdiction to do anything. It can only make recommendations. But it can only make those recommendations when it designates the area as very high severity, not moderate or just high severity. So it's a complicated regulatory environment.
Complicated, and it seems to hang on syntax, I guess.
It, in some ways, it's syntax, but it's also a balance of power. Local authorities fought back on these laws as being an unfunded state mandate.
Huh. The thing to remember about this fire And you quote a woman in the story, actually, as saying this. We were a subdivision in the middle of a city. We're not near the hills and the woods.
You cannot blame those people for thinking they were safe.
Yeah.
They didn't feel like they were out in the woods where pine trees surrounding the house were going to be exploding. And one of the primary fire prevention methods is what's called defensible space,
right,
which is a requirement to keep 100 to 200 feet of brush cleared away. Well, these houses had defensible space, and so there's no reason they shouldn't have felt secure there. This is going to be a more common occurrence, according to some of the experts I spoke to, because of climate change and because of the penetration of population into rural areas.
Doug Smith of the Los Angeles Times writing about the fires and the mapping, actually, of those fires up in Sonoma. Doug, thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
Coming up.
So I just said, F them. I'm doing it. And I did. And it worked out great.
I don't know, man. Gets me in trouble every single time. First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 85 points on this Monday, 0.3%, 22,956. The NASDAQ up 18, about 0.25%, 6,624. The S&P 500 advanced 4 points, 0.1%. 25 and 57. Bank stocks boomed in this strong third quarter earnings season. JP Morgan Chase up 2%, Capital One up 1.75%, Bank of America grew about 1.5%. In retail today, Sears down 11.5% as Bruce Berkowitz, he's the head of a major Sears shareholder called Fairholme Capital Management, quit that retailer's board of directors. Speaking of retailers, Nordstrom discounted 5.25% as the chain put off its bid to go private. Energy stocks mostly up on rising crude oil prices. Yes, Iran and Kirkuk in Iraq and all that, but there's more to it. Duke Energy gained 0.3% and Adarco brightened 1.3% today. Bond prices fell. Yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.30%, and you are listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. In a couple of different sets of public remarks today, President Trump said he stands by his decision last week cutting off what are known as CSRs, subsidies mostly for low-income customers in the individual healthcare market. The president also said Obamacare basically doesn't exist anymore. Be that as it may, people are still thinking about their medical bills and how they are going to pay them. Perfect fodder, really, for our series that we call My Economy, How You Are Getting By in Your Economic Day-to-Day. Today's dispatch comes to us from Irwin Kwan. He's in Natick, Massachusetts.
There are a couple things that you hear, especially from people who advocate financial independence, and it's, you know, have 6 months' expenses, make sure that your expenses are less than your income, and we have that covered. All the costs of healthcare and disasters, like God forbid if someone gets like cancer of someone in my family and we have to start paying regular expenses, you don't know what those costs are. You just know they're high, and it's so high compared to almost anything else in your life that you have to pay for. My wife, when she was younger, she had to take an ambulance ride. It's 5 minutes long, the ride, and the bill from the hospital was over $10,000. She had to fight her insurance to try to get that reduced and reduced and reduced over time until finally, you know, they managed to agree to a reasonable amount. Your health is really important, and all of the stuff is really important, but you feel like there's this weird disconnect between the way that you pay insurance and kind of like the direct value you get of it in that sense. I guess it's pretty timely because open enrollment season for insurance is coming up, right? And every year, you know, your employer contacts you and is like, you know, These things have changed on your insurance, right? As I get older, I'm going to have to start checklisting these things off and making sure, okay, this is now covered. Oh, okay, that's not covered anymore. You know, do I want to do that? Like, I'm pretty fortunate and I'm worried. I can't even imagine what people who struggle to get health insurance and then have to struggle to pay for it. It doesn't seem sustainable. There seems like there has to be a more efficient way.
That was Irwin Kwan out of Natick, Massachusetts. Take a second, would you, and tell us your economic story. Marketplace.org/myeconomy is the place. Almost every big-ish city in this country is facing some version of the affordable housing problem. Too many people, not enough housing stock, rising rents, and home prices that are out of reach. Here in California, we know it's well one possible, if not entirely intuitive solution, is the space that exists in people's backyards. Thanks to a change in state law out here, it's now much easier for California homeowners to build what are called accessory dwelling units on their properties. Granny flats is the term you might know. And policymakers are hoping that'll lead to a whole slew of affordable housing in Los Angeles and well beyond, as Marketplace's Aaron Schrank reports.
2009 was a tough year for Ira Belgrade. He'd been a Hollywood talent manager for decades when his wife, who was also his business partner, died suddenly from Lyme disease.
I fell apart. My business fell apart.
He could no longer afford the mortgage on his central L.A. home.
How was I going to tell my 2.5-year-old, no, we got to move, you can't have that bedroom anymore? I didn't want to do that.
That's when Belgrade decided to turn his detached home office, which had once been a garage, into a 2-bedroom rental apartment.
And that would absolutely help me pay my mortgage.
But when he brought this idea to the city for permits, they said no. Under L.A.'s strict regulations, Belgrade's lot was too small, the unit was too close to the main house, it needed covered parking, a whole list of things.
So I just said, F them, I'm doing it. And I did. And it worked out great.
That is, until someone reported him. After an inspection and fine, Belgrade was told to get legal, he'd have to make changes to the tune of $50,000. That left him in limbo until he heard about a state lawmaker pushing reform in Sacramento. Turns out, planners had begun to see backyard structures, from converted garages to full freestanding houses, as a solution to the housing crisis.
There's a lot of free land in the city, and it's in people's backyards.
Dana Cuff directs UCLA's City Lab. The think tank has been studying the issue for a decade. L.A. has miles and miles of single-family homes, each with a backyard. By relaxing backyard home-building rules, Cuff says cities can boost affordable housing stock without spending any money. And families can turn their garages and backyards into sources of income.
Basically, it puts the growth of the city in the hands of individual property owners so they get the benefits.
Cuff actually wrote the California bill to relax those tough requirements and fees for backyard homes. It became law this year. And while local zoning and safety laws still apply, it's much, much easier to become a backyard landlord. Cuff says there are critics, of course, those who fear what it'll do to their neighborhood.
That it might increase traffic, that it might make parking more difficult.
Valid concerns in L.A., Cuff says, but backyard homes should pop up gradually, giving time for communities to respond. Meanwhile, the private sector is taking notice.
There couldn't be a better time to get into this.
Alexis Rivas runs a company called Cover, which designs, builds, and installs prefabricated backyard dwellings. It placed its first home last week.
It's a huge market. There's over 500,000 single-family homes in Los Angeles with backyards that have the potential for a structure like this.
Rivas plans to produce 150 homes per year from his L.A. factory. His one-bedroom backyard homes range in price from about $100,000 to $400,000, depending on the design and materials used. Rivas isn't the only one who sees a business opportunity here. After waiting 7 years, Ira Belgrade says his backyard home was the first in L.A. legalized under the new law. And now?
I've started a company called Yimby L.A., yes, in my backyard, Los Angeles.
A consulting business to help others get their backyard homes approved. That still takes some time, money, and know-how, Belgrade says, but with the law finally on his side, it's much easier than his first time around. In Los Angeles, I'm Aaron Schrank for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, about which I can't quite decide how I feel. Google Photos announced a refinement to its algorithms today. Now, not only can it recognize you and your friends and your loved ones, it can also recognize your pets. Not like just that Shadow is a dog, but that it's Shadow, your dog. Cool or creepy? I don't know yet. Full disclosure, by the way, I do have a dog named Shadow. All right, the Dow up 85 points today, about 0.3%, 22,956, oh so close. The NASDAQ up 18 points, 0.25%, 66.24. S&P 500 up 4 points, about 0.1%, 25.57. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner, Robert Garova, Jenny Josephson, and Daisy Palacios. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.